You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the International Association of Machinists Local 778 and IBEW Local 124. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers Local Lodge 778 in Kansas City, Missouri, represents thousands of working people in and around the metro. Our members work in a variety of industries, including automotive, manufacturing, freight, and logistics, and public works. We proudly support the Heartland Labor Forum as it continues to educate our friends and neighbors about the issues affecting Missouri's working class families. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We have been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you are not finding your electrical contractor at IBEW Local 124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. We thank our underwriters for their support. And on tonight's show, we'll have another candidate for mayor, Steve Miller, a construction lawyer, who says it's all about connections like transportation, infrastructure, and neighborhoods. Then, unions are intended to level the playing field with the boss. But what if workers become their own bosses? We'll talk to UMKC economist Eric Olson about worker cooperatives and ask if they might be the future for organized labor and for organized workplaces. Sorry, everybody here is coughing. In the news, Missouri Republicans are trying to undo the votes of the people, and striking Denver teachers win. Hooray. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Ariana Eckel. Stay tuned for the news.
Now to the news from our side, February 14th, 2019. In the second teacher strike in as many months, it looks like the Denver teachers, like the Los Angeles teachers, have won. The union and the school district reached a tentative agreement today, which, if ratified, could send them back to school very soon. There aren't many details, except Vox reports the school district and the Denver Classroom Teacher Association, the union, say the agreement includes an average of 11.7% pay raise and annual cost of living increases. The union represents more than 2,000 teachers. Staff, bus drivers, and cafeteria workers may also get a raise apart from the agreement with the teachers' union. The issue, which really had the teachers up in arms, was the need to overhaul the merit pay system, which relies heavily on annual bonuses that fluctuate from year to year. This left salaries flat and difficult to predict, and also led to favoritism. The new system will place more emphasis on education and training when considering promotions, while keeping some bonuses in place. Where will they find the $23 million to pay for this? The district agreed to cut back on administrative costs and will eliminate about 150 positions in the school's central office. Five-figure bonuses for senior school administrators will also come to an end. This is a big victory against the corporatization of education, which has plagued both universities and the K-12 schools for the last couple decades. Henry Roman, president of the union, described it as a historic deal. No longer will our students see their education disrupted because their teachers cannot afford to stay in the classrooms. In many places besides Denver, teachers' salaries have stagnated while administrators multiply like rabbits and increase the work of teachers with more bureaucracy. Meanwhile, top administrators get salaries in multiples higher than classroom teachers.
The Missouri legislature seems intent this year on undermining the will of the people. It looks like they don't have the nerve to pass right to work again after Republicans' stunning defeat last August when 67% of Missourians repealed that law. But they're hard at work trying to undo the votes of the majority by blatantly passing rules to weaken the constitutional amendment known as Clean Missouri and introducing bills to wipe out the recently passed minimum wage increase. Clean Missouri, which passed with approval of 62% of voters, requires legislators' emails, calendars, and other materials to be open to public scrutiny. House Bill 445 will not only keep most records of legislators private, but it also gives municipal and school officials the same rights to government secrecy. Representative John Carpenter from Kansas City told the Kansas City Star that if signed into law, this bill would be the most radical undermining of open records and transparency law in state history. The bill would still have to pass the Senate and then be signed by the governor. If all that happens, then it's probable that it would be challenged in the courts.
Not to be bested by the House this week, Mike Cunningham, a senator from Rogersville, says he'll introduce a bill to create a new lower minimum wage rate for workers under the age of 18. His argument is that in the supermarket he managed, he'd have to lay off workers rather than pay them the new higher minimum wage of $8.60 an hour. So he's doing this to stimulate youth employment. The fact is that most minimum wage workers are adults, and Cunningham's handiwork would likely mean employers could fire an adult and hire the low-cost teen. Not only that, Cunningham also wants to freeze the minimum wage for tipped workers at $4.30 an hour, which is currently half of the regular minimum. It turns out that in Cunningham's home county, almost one in three workers will benefit from Proposition B that raised the minimum wage.
St. Charles Republican State Representative Philip Cristofanelli wants to criminalize unions. He attached an amendment to what was otherwise a good bill, House Bill 397, that strengthens the laws against human trafficking. The amendment categorizes labor organizations as criminal street gangs. Mike Lewis, president of the Missouri AFL-CIO, called Cristofanelli's bluff. He said, "This is an obvious ploy to force politicians who support labor to vote no on a bill that is summarized as protecting children from sex trafficking." "Well, we are not going to fall for it. Protections for children is a top priority, and if it means we have to take some name-calling and cheap shots from Cristofanelli and his cronies, then so be it." He urged politicians to support the bill. Who is Philip Cristofanelli? He's a 30-year-old who cut his teeth on the Tea Party. In 2011, while a senior at Washington University, he enrolled in a labor studies program at the University of Missouri-St. Louis, stole tapes in class, sent them to Andrew Breitbart, who had them deceptively edited to post on Breitbart's webpage to make it appear that the students were being taught violence and sabotage. Then the St. Louis Tea Party began a campaign to get the professors fired. As a result, Don Gilgem, labor studies professor and business manager for the operating engineers, was fired from both of his jobs. Cristofanelli told Gilgem that there are no ethics in politics, only winners and losers. Gilgem subsequently got his job back after faculty, students from across the state exposed Cristofanelli's theft and fraud and pressured the chancellor of UMSL to reverse his firing. But clearly, that was no deterrent to either the state's Republican Party or the voters of St. Charles who put Cristofanelli in the legislature.
At Tuesday's meeting of the Kansas City AFL-CIO, Elise Martini, business manager of the Greater Kansas City Building and Construction Trades Council, reported that there's a new agreement with the airlines and the developer to move ahead with construction of the new airport. The agreement caps the cost at $1.5 billion. They still have to do an environmental study. Also, Spirit and Allegiant Airlines both only want a 5-year lease, while the rest of the carriers are in for 30-year leases. She said the building trades unions are 100% in favor of the new agreement. The news tonight was read by Tom Gepkin, Jen Zaman, Michael Savoir, and Jeff Milliken.
And thank you all on the news crew. This is Judy Ansel. And for the last 2 months, the Heartland Labor Forum has been getting to know the changing list of candidates for mayor. There are 11 on that list currently. And tonight's talk is with Steve Miller, and it makes him our fifth to be interviewed. Steve Miller is a construction attorney in Kansas City. He previously served as chairman of the Missouri Highways and Transportation Commission, where he oversaw billions of dollars in infrastructure projects, weathering budget cuts along the way. He's a product of a strong Catholic education, having attended Rockhurst High School and Notre Dame University. And welcome to the show, Steve.
Great to be with you, Judy.
There's so much to talk about here. I know we're not going to get too far, but first off, congrats on a big article in the Star this morning. So if people want to find out more about you, they can go there.
Thanks.
Yeah. So first off, you have worked on a number of manual labor jobs, you told me, and you were a member of a union. You want to tell us just briefly a little bit about that?
Right. You know, my father had, my mother had 9 children, and I was the oldest, and they always believed in, even as my father was a lawyer, always believed in that value of hard work. He himself, he'd like to just tell me he'd been an old hod carrier down when they were building Municipal Auditorium, and by goodness, you know, hard labor taught him the important values of honesty and hard work, and so he always made sure that all of us were doing that. So to help put myself through school, I worked a number of jobs, and I actually joined the Laborers Union when I was in college and was schlepping concrete and wheelbarrows to help build the KCATA garage at 18th and Paseo.
Cool.
Spent summers with an air chipper hammer chipping off burrs on large metal members. Spent another summer working to fabricate materials to be used in blast furnaces. And they were really formative for me. I understood how hard every day so many people work in our community. I understood the importance of a good wage and the dignity of work for everybody.
Okay, well, good. Let's hope that shows up in your politics, I guess.
Yes, it does.
So obviously this is a show about working people, and you know, I just looked up the stats, and while union membership in Kansas City isn't great, it is significant. Turns out there are over 100,000 people who work in this city who belong to unions or are covered by union contracts. So that's 1 in 10 workers. And then, of course, there's a ton of workers who don't have union protection. So tell us, what's your vision for making Kansas City a city that works for working people, where you can afford to live here and where you can have a real community?
Right. Well, I think the secret, as I said before, for everyone is the dignity of work and a fair wage. And one of the things that I think the next mayor has to do is to have that big vision of how we drive forward this city to claim opportunities in this very competitive world that are going to pay good jobs for everyone. So I think if we sit back and look at our hometown, sometimes we dream too small, not too big. If we look at Kansas City, Missouri, the city itself, it is the largest city in a 500-mile radius in the wealthiest country in the world. And you've got to go all the way north to Minneapolis, over 500 miles, west to Denver, 600 miles, south to over 500 miles to Dallas, and all the way over to Nashville to find a bigger city. Mm-hmm. And we need to take stock of the great assets that we have here. And sometimes we just focus on what we don't have. But if you look at it, we sit at one of the great river systems of the world. And we've virtually turned our back on it in many respects. Almost every other city in the world embraces it as an opportunity for commerce and jobs and economic opportunity as a result, as a use for recreation and, you know, growing the community. We are the second busiest rail center in the entire country, number one in tonnage. We're behind only Chicago. And actually, you know, we have more trains going through Kansas City today than we did in 1945 at the height of passenger rail. And right here with Kansas City Southern, we are the spine for traffic through North America. And then you look at a city that has a bio corridor that extends from Manhattan at Kansas State University to Columbia on the Missouri side. And we sit right here at the bio-animal-human health corridor with places like the Stower Center. And we have a center for architectural and engineering excellence where the stadiums and arenas in this world, 70% of them in some fashion are designed right here in Kansas City. And then we look at what we're doing right now. Our community's embraced a lot of capital improvements, everywhere from a new airport to infrastructure. And we have all kinds of opportunities for our trades and laborers. You know, our challenge right now, quite frankly, is preparing this city to be a 21st city and getting people into the right positions to be successful in a whole variety of jobs. But it starts with mayor leadership that has that bigger vision for the city we can be and helps all of us get there so that we have a shared prosperity that everyone in the community enjoys.
Sounds good.
It's an exciting time. It's the most important election for mayor in certainly my lifetime.
Really?
Absolutely.
And that's not just because you're running?
That's not just because I'm running. And I think Kansas Cityans agree because we've had 10 mayoral debates so far. We got 24 more. And everywhere we go, people are turning out. Mm-hmm. Because I think they find that mayoral leadership really makes a difference. And if you look at it, right now we've pushed, you know, of user fees and taxpayer fees, almost $6 billion that's been pushed onto the table. And the public's given us 75% approval rating to go forward with our infrastructure project and with KCI. These are projects that could be transformative for the city if done properly. But if we don't do them well, not only are we going to betray the trust of the voters, but we're going to set this city back for a generation. That's why it's so pivotal. If we want to dream big dreams, we need to do well with what's on the table and keep working to build this 21st century city.
So I'm curious to know how your career as a construction lawyer has prepared you to be mayor.
Yeah. So 35 years as a construction lawyer, and I like to say what that's really been is solving problems. You know, building great cities like Kansas City is complex. And it means that you have to be competent and you have to be prepared to be in dialogue. And when issues come up, you have to find ways to resolve it. And you can't grind to a gridlock like we see happening with government. The reality is when we start a project, we have an obligation to get it finished. And for 35 years, I've been doing that, not just in Kansas City, but around the country. I have sorted out problems on things like international airports, transportation systems like streetcars, infrastructure projects like highways and bridges,
and sewer systems. Give me an example.
Yeah, so I mean, I'll tell you, I was involved with things that were going on with Denver International Airport, with Coors Field that managed a downtown baseball stadium that transformed Denver. I was involved in transportation issues out in Boston, Miller Park up in Milwaukee.
Okay, and what kinds of issues were like the tough ones to solve?
Gosh, you know, there's a wide variety of them, but a lot of times, there are, disputes that occur when they're unexpected, changes that are occurring in projects, and people have to figure out who's going to be responsible for it and how they go forward. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are issues on the front end that arise about, hiring issues like, a diverse workforce and opportunities for minority and for women. And so sometimes you have to work through those. It's such a wide gamut, and that's why 35 years of experience It's just serendipitous. We're kind of lucky, I think, that at this point in time we have a candidate that actually brings that expertise at a time when we need it most.
So you were head of the Missouri Highway and Transportation Commission.
Correct.
Right. Okay. So what did that entail, and how did that prepare you for mayor?
Yeah, we don't know this in Missouri, but the commission that I was on is unique in the entire United States. Because in most states, all the power to direct policy for transportation is usually held by the governor. But in Missouri, it's this commission that holds all the power of a governor, and the governor has no authority except really to appoint someone. And in other states, you rely upon the legislature to appropriate money for transportation. But in Missouri, by constitution, it's deemed appropriated at the time it's collected, whether it's at the pump for fuel tax or licensing fees or sales tax. So this commission had to assume the responsibility for competent delivery of services and building a structure throughout the state. And I was privileged to serve two terms as the chair, which really functions much like a mayor of a city.
When was that?
I served from 2009 until 2016. So, and your listeners would be interested. I 7 years of service to our state. It would not have occurred but for the labor organizations in Kansas City. They actually stepped up. And they wanted representation here because they understood how important infrastructure was, and they put my name up to Governor Nixon. I had no political connection. It was really the loud voice of labor saying we need someone that's one of our own that understands Kansas City, somebody that's going to bring the competency and the passion to do the job. And I was supposed to sign on for 6 years, but the governor actually asked me to serve a seventh year. And that's really what lit my fire in terms of what's possible as mayor of Kansas City, because in leading MoDOT, I was leading at the highest level an organization that's actually bigger than Kansas City. Bigger budget, more employees, more land ownership, more infrastructure.
But wasn't our infrastructure deteriorating all during that time?
Well, it was, and it continues to. And this is what I spent those 7 years is going around and trying to communicate to all Missourians the importance of continuing to invest in our infrastructure, because it generates jobs for building the infrastructure, but it also helps create opportunity to get us around safely. And I will say, you know, in Kansas City, again, largely the voice of labor, we had two statewide initiatives, both of which I worked on. Both did not pass in Missouri, but it wasn't because of Kansas City. It carried here in Kansas City, and it carried because of the support of labor. And that's why, as mayor, I think we have a great opportunity, because I think we actually have a visionary people. I think we've got visionary groups that are ready to grow this city. They just need the right leader.
Okay, so one of the issues here that's really controversial is the issue of tax incentives.
Right.
And, you know, some people want to cap them, and there's going to be, I guess, an initiative that may or may not be on some ballot that would actually cap tax incentives. There are folks who say they do them in the wrong places,
right,
and that they're not, you know, like getting rid of blight, and that they favor the rich, and there are people who say that it's developers who are driving the whole process.
Yeah.
Where are you at?
Well, first of all, the incentives, which I really like to call investments in ourselves, they are important. So I'm not in favor of doing away with them at all, because we can see a lot of what's happened in Kansas City, the transformation, much needed, of our downtown and crossroads was largely accomplished by that. You know, some we struck better deals on than others. But I think now, if I would call it Kansas City version 2.0, we need to be smarter and better about how we do it. And I'm not a fan of putting artificial constraints on it, but I am a fan of having clearly articulated plan for what Kansas City ought to become and clearly articulated criteria that make certain that we're doing the investments in the right way, in the right place. And I do believe that if our taxpayers make that investment, that they have a right to expect a certain amount of return. So we're having this conversation right now about affordable housing. So if we're going to be investing in housing, and if what we need is affordable housing, I think the public has a right to demand that there be some component of that. And I think it's going to be the leadership of the next mayor. These are not simple solutions, but it means that we have to put together a clear plan, identify objectives, give everybody the rules of the game, and execute.
What about east of Troost, the area which, you know, suffers from the most blight,
right,
and where people, you know, have really suffered for years and years for a lack of investment?
Our city is only as strong as the least of our brothers and sisters. And cities are gauged on how well they take care of all parts of the city. And primarily, I don't mean take care, I mean provide opportunity. So our goal going forward is to create a city for our children, one that our children are demanding, which is diverse, inclusive, and equitable. And that means economic inclusivity as well. So I think we have to be really intentional on the east side. You can't, to really leverage the things that we need to do, we're going to have private money. you can't make developers or private money go where they don't want to go. But by having clearly articulated policies that provide those investments, I think you can gradually drive those things. And that's also why I wouldn't put caps on things, because we know, for instance, you know, we have a brand new grocery store at Linwood and Prospect, you know, and that took a lot of city investment where we couldn't get private money in there. So I'm very hesitant to put artificial restraints that would tie our hands and prevent us from doing kind of some signature projects like that we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's going to be something on the ballot in April about early childhood education that the mayor is really pushing, and it involves a sales tax,
right?
And it would distribute money for early childhood education, not just to public schools, but also to private institutions, including churches.
Right.
The teachers' union and the school district are both opposed to
right.
it. Where are you at on it?
Yeah, and I have not made a final decision on that, because there are very strong groups on both sides offering really compelling reasons for doing that. So you're exactly right. You know, I know in conversations that we have, you know, our school superintendents that are not in favor of it, the Urban League, the NAACP, and other groups. But then I also listen to the parents of young children that, you know, they're desperate to see something happen. They'd like to see it happen. We have the other groups like the Chamber of Commerce and the Civic Council and other groups that do favor it. I want to see us do something for early childhood development. I'm not certain whether we have on the tables the right thing, but the jury's still out. And I think it's really important. I think Kansas City wants leaders that just don't make immediate knee-jerk reactions based upon sound bites, but really take the time to listen. And I am listening. I am getting around and listening to everybody on this issue. And I will tell you, I find people very split on that. I haven't made a decision yet, but I'm still thinking about it, and it's incredibly important.
Well, I know you've been connected with Cristo Rey School.
Right, yeah.
And you also told me that you were on the board of Don Bosco Center. So I want to ask you, last question, we've only got like a minute
okay.
left. I want to ask you what you think we can do to make Kansas City a more welcoming place for our immigrant population. The legislature has preempted us from passing any kind of sanctuary cities kinds of ordinances. What can we do to make our immigrants feel safe and not worry about ICE coming to get them?
Right. I don't think we need an ordinance to make Kansas City a welcoming place. I think Kansas City by nature is welcoming, and I think we need to make certain that we have a law enforcement, our local law enforcement, that's aligned with that. You know, if there's not a problem in Kansas City, let's not mess with it. I think we need to continue to work with our not-for-profit organizations, our church-based organizations, to continue to be the welcoming city. You know, as you mentioned, throughout the 1990s, I spent 10 years working to settle immigrants in this country. We're all immigrants. And for me, it's thrilling to watch people have a start. And I think Kansas City is a great place to be. I think, you know, we can see, you know, a lot of the things we enjoy in this city are the products of the immigrants that come in.
Absolutely.
And I think culturally and as a people, we can continue to do that. And we don't need an ordinance to make that happen. And right in our community every day, I see people that are making Kansas City a welcoming place. And as mayor, I'm going to make certain that we're known not only as Kansas City, but as Kindness City.
Oh, how nice. Is that going on your campaign's
slogan? I think it sounds good.
Kindness
yeah.
City?
Yeah. You heard it here first.
All right.
Kindness City. All right?
Thank you, Steve Miller,
great.
For being on the show. I wish we could talk more.
Great. Thank
good
you, Judy.
Good luck with your campaign.
Thanks so much.
And stay tuned. Sean Saving is going to be interviewing Eric Olson about worker cooperatives.
Hello, this is Martha Lally, producer of KKFI 90.1 FM's Anything Goes show with Charles Ferrugia and Carol Jean Barta. Hey, Carol, how would you like to learn some secrets about how to really make your best deal on a new or used car?
Well, Martha, there's no reason to buy a lemon, and I'd like to know what the pitfalls are.
Learn the best way to buy a car from insider car broker Alan Moore.
That's on the Anything Goes show, Friday at noon.
Are you interested in identifying and conserving, or even recreating, a priceless bit of natural habitat in your community? Then tune in for the next Eco Radio KC with guests Courtney Masterson from Native Lands LLC and Patty Ragsdale from Happy Apples Farm. Both are leaders of the Kaw Valley Native Plant Coalition and are passionate and knowledgeable advocates for native plants. That's Eco Radio KC, Mondays at 6 p.m. on 90.1 KKFI Community Radio.
KKFI presents an evening with Medea Benjamin at All Souls UU Church on Saturday, February 16th. The talk will focus on building a peace movement in an era of endless war. Co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange, she's famous for her gutsy confrontations with powerful plutocrats, an expert on the Middle East, and a leader in the peace movement. Reception with local activist groups and book signing will follow her talk Saturday, February 16th at All Souls UU Church, 6:30 to 9 p.m. This fundraiser is a service of the KKFI News and Public Affairs Committee. kkfi.org/events to reserve your seat today.
And welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. As a listener to this show, you're probably more than aware of the difficulties unions face today. Union density, the proportion of workers who are in a union, has been slowly falling for decades and now sits well below 11%. Even though some 60% of workers say they would join a union if they could, active union busting by companies, anti-union policymaking by government, structural changes to the economy, and the ever-evolving nature of work and the workplace all contribute to suppressing efforts to organize new workers into unions. This has led many in the struggle for worker justice and dignity to explore alternatives to the traditional trade union model. One such approach, the worker-owned cooperative, says if you can't beat the boss, boss yourselves. By owning the means of production directly, workers not only run the company, they get to keep the profits for themselves. Here tonight to talk about worker cooperatives and how they can improve the lives of workers, as well as their communities, is Eric Olson, professor of economics at UMKC. Professor Olson, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me.
So around here, we're probably most familiar with co-ops in instances of rural community, you know, rural area of the country, farmers cooperatives, maybe even a consumer's co-op like a credit union.
Yep.
But I suspect few of our listeners have ever had any interaction or experience with what would be called a worker-owned cooperative. So first of all, just explain what is that? And
sure.
How is that different from a credit union or a farmer's co-op?
Yeah, so those are all cooperatives. The three main different types of cooperatives, as you mentioned, there's consumer cooperatives, producer cooperatives, and then worker cooperatives. And they're all cooperatives in the sense that they're all owned by their membership. So in a consumer co-op, the members are the people who are the patrons of the business. So, for example, REI is probably the largest consumer cooperative in the United States, and we have one here in the Kansas City metropolitan area. It's owned by the people who work there. The producer co-ops are owned by small producers, agricultural producers, or artisans, for example. Ethanol plants, grain elevators, and so forth are collectively owned by small producers. And a worker cooperative is owned by the people who work there. So unlike REI, that's owned by the people who shop there, a worker cooperative is owned by the people who work there. And they have both ownership and control rights. Those are the two main things that we think about when we think about an enterprise, which is who essentially has the claim to the profits of the firm. That's sort of a profit rights or a ownership right. And then we also think about them having the control right, which is who makes the decisions about the firm. So in a worker cooperative, the workers both own and control the firm themselves. So they receive the profits, and they make the decisions about how the business is going to be run, either through direct democracy or through participatory democracy by voting people to represent them.
So yes, let's talk about that. So how do work cooperatives make decisions? I mean, how do they manage the day-to-day operations of the
facility? It varies. It varies tremendously depending on the size of them. Yeah, because for example, the United States is a relatively small worker cooperative sector. They're actually quite large in Europe. In Europe, particularly in the southern tier countries, France, Italy, Spain, they all have very large worker cooperative sectors, and so there you'd actually see much also a great diversity of institutional forms. In the U.S., we also do have some, they're primarily smaller businesses in the United States, but there are some larger ones, right? The largest worker co-op in the U.S. is Cooperative Home Care Associates in the Bronx, which is, they have well over 1,000 worker members at CHCA. And so the decision-making process there is going to be different than it might be at, say, the Cheese Board Collective in Berkeley, California, which is less than 100 employees, but also very old and well-established cooperative. So some of them can use, I guess I should answer your question more directly, which is that some of them can use direct democracy, where essentially they can get into a room together and they can take a vote. And then other ones select people to represent them, just the same way we do in a representative democracy, and those people go forward and make decisions, or essentially they're electing the people who are in management roles.
Okay. And so then are these cooperatives usually, is it an even share? Do people have different proportional shares depending
sure.
on their role in the company
or how long
they've been there, or how does that work?
Yeah, and again, it also varies. There are some that are very egalitarian, and it's not just one member, one vote, but also one member, one share, and the profits are distributed by shares. But very often they're distributed by, and again, this is similar with other cooperatives, by the degree to which the members participate in the business. So you might have members who work more hours than others, for example, and are going to accrue a greater both wage and a residual claimancy or profit share as well. But they still would operate on a one member, one vote basis. The politics would be shared.
I would take it then that you would still have to have supervisors or something, or people who are in charge, but maybe they're, I mean, how do they...
It varies.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
It varies. And again, I can give you an example of two that I'm familiar with. Out in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's a longstanding network of worker cooperatives out there. And Alvarado Street Bakery is a large commercial bakery, 100% owned by the 100% worker cooperative who owns all the equity of the firm. They look, they have a management structure that would be similar to other large commercial bakeries, the difference being that the workers who work there are the ones who choose the people who are in management positions rather than it being decided by the owners of the firm who are not the people who work there.
Oh, okay. So you choose your own boss.
Exactly. Okay. And I'll give you another example. There's Rainbow Grocery, which is a well-established grocery store in the Bay Area. They actually have no real distinction between line workers and managers. So they have dispersed and horizontal management where they engage in worker co-monitoring, where they essentially manage one another. So there's no one model. There's people who find the model that they find works well for their business. So Alvarado Street looks different from Rainbow Grocery, but they're both worker cooperatives, and they've made those decisions because they think it's best for them.
And so if you want to leave... a cooperative. I mean, I'm sure again it's going to change vary with everyone. But then, do you have some? Do you get? How do? You get a buyout if you leave?
Yeah.
You take your cash out your share or something in the company.
It's whether they have capital accounts or equity accounts, and that's And over the years, this has changed. There was a time when it was typical that worker cooperative. If you left, you left your equity stake behind. You didn't. You only remained an owner, or when you left your employment, you also lost your ownership rights. That it used to be. And over time, that can create certain problems for the firm around investment and the willingness for firms to invest. Because if I have the choice between investing in something that's going to be there for longer than I am, than a long-lived 30-year asset, I might not be willing to do it. So what they've done now is most cooperatives have brought about capital accounts where I would own a percentage of the firm depending on how long I worked there and how much investment we engaged in while I was there.
So it'd be like kind of like the way a pension works.
Exactly.
You can leave your employment, but you've vested in the system.
That's right.
And you maybe lose some rights to vote. You can't. I'm still a member of California State Pension Plan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a member of the union anymore. I can't vote on contracts, but I still have a pension invested.
Right.
So
when you'd leave a co-op in that situation, essentially they would buy you out. They would sell back your shares or your claim over the capital of the firm. You'd sell it back to the cooperative.
Okay. So you said that worker cooperative. You know, it's not terribly common in the U.S. It really doesn't seem to be very common around this part of the country.
We were
looking up some data trying to figure out who we actually have around here. And in Kansas City, I think the only one we've really found was the Southwest Boulevard Family Healthcare practice, which is right down here on Southwest Boulevard and Rainbow. There's a couple I found, Purple Carrot Co-op in Lawrence, which I think is a food truck, it looks like. you know, I think Ad Astra Books and Coffee in Salina.
Okay.
Which I think I've been to, actually. Uh-huh. That was a co-op. And like a Milkweed Mercantile out in Rutledge, Missouri, northeast okay. Missouri. And that was the all that I think we were mm-hmm. finding. Maybe our listeners might know of some others that are worker cooperatives. How many co-ops are in the U.S.?
So there's about 450 in the U.S. right now, and there's actually reasonably good data on this now, and it comes from the Democracy at Work Institute, which is associated with the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. There's a real energy in the worker cooperative sector now, and in large part, or at least in part, it's coming from the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, which was created in 2004. Prior to that, there was not a national federation in the U.S. like there are in European countries who have developed these sectors. So Dowie's research shows, Democracy at Work Institute research shows, it's about 450 active co-ops and worker cooperatives in the U.S. They employ about 8,000 people. A large percentage of that would be in this one Cooperative Healthcare Associates in the Bronx, mm-hmm. which is primarily almost exclusively low-income women of color who do home care and formerly would have been essentially freelancing this work, who have been brought together into that co-op. But again, so there's about 450 of them. Most of them are small in the U.S. That's atypical. You look at other developed countries, they actually tend to be larger, more concentrated in manufacturing, for example, than industries.
Spain has the Mondragon.
Cooperative Corporation. Okay. Yeah, it's a network of worker cooperatives there in the Basque Country. It's been around since the 1950s and has started off manufacturing appliances. And became one of the largest appliance manufacturers in Spain, but has branched out into other industries as well. They have service sector industries. They have a bank. They do research and development for companies like Microsoft.
Wow.
Yeah. They're actually they're quite successful in a whole variety of different industries.
Well, to remind our listeners, this is the Heartland Labor Forum, and I am Sean Saving. I'm talking with Eric Olson, professor of economics at UMKC, about worker-owned cooperatives. I want to talk about this point here of how, you know, the Mondragon cooperative, how big it is and how diversified it is. It makes you wonder, like, well, how did they get the financing to start this up? How do workers, you know, start a business?
That's
In the United States, we kind of think, oh, it takes the billionaire to have this capital to invest and create a company. Then he goes out and hires people. So if workers want to do this themselves, that's kind of seems like one of the hurdles,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, that's traditionally been one of the more difficult aspects of it. The way Mondragon did was they started small and then they reinvested and grew. They're intrinsic to their foundation was the idea that they were established in order to create employment in the Basque Country. And so one of their objectives all along was to grow and to become bigger and to add for employment. But that's atypical for worker cooperatives. The way they get started, in the U.S., historically they have started as businesses from scratch, which really limited them in the size that they could be in, as well as the industries that they could be in. So you saw a lot of retail establishments, for example, whether it be a restaurant or a mm-hmm. bookstore or right. things like that, which are very low barriers to entry, low capital barriers to entry. The Moosewood Collective in Ithaca, right. for example, is right. an example of a worker cooperative like that. And the what we're seeing more of now, because it's become very clear that if worker cooperatives are going to make a positive impact on the working lives of a large numbers of people, that there needs to be other mechanisms whereby to do this. And there's been funding mechanisms that have been established, particularly I know in Western Massachusetts there's a cooperative development fund that's been established there and that people have been donating to and that you can actually invest in and potentially even earn a return by financing the development of worker cooperatives.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Okay.
But there is what I think is really exciting now is what's going on is there's a movement towards cooperative development through what we think of as ownership succession, which is the conversion of existing businesses into cooperatively run enterprises. And the advantage of that is that an existing business has equity mm-hmm. that you can then leverage in order to finance the transition of an exiting owner. And when owners exit, they typically would look for someone to purchase it who might be often, for example, one of their competitors.
Right, right.
The problem with that is very often that's bad for the people who work there
yep.
because it means that they're going to be reduced their employment.
Is Bob's Red Mill, did they become a cooperative when I know he sold it to the company?
Bob's Red Mill is an ESOP, right? They're 100% ESOP company now, and that's a related but a separate way of organizing a business. But ESOPs have traditionally been created employee stock ownership plans. They've traditionally been created through ownership succession, the transition mm-hmm. of an existing business. And that's one of the ways through some of the cross-fertilization that's gone on between the ESOP community and the worker cooperative community has been they've been learning from one another. And this is in part some groups that myself and others have been involved with that have really worked to bring these people together. And so that model is starting to move over to the worker cooperative world, which is the ownership succession model, which is to take an established business and to convert it from a conventional business into a worker cooperative form, because it makes it possible the to borrow against the equity of that firm
sure.
in order to transition out an existing owner.
And so these ESOPs, these mm-hmm. employee stock ownership
plans
yep. programs, what's stopping those from? I mean, if the employees say own the majority or 100% of the shares of the mm-hmm. of the company,
yep.
I mean, they could, as the shareholders, decide to turn it into a co-op, right?
It's slightly more complicated than that. And I mean, the ESOPs are an interesting case, particularly in Kansas City, because we have large, well-known businesses in Kansas City that are either 100% or majority owned through an employee stock ownership plan. Burns & McDonnell, Black & Veatch, Hy-Vee Foods, these are businesses that we hear about on a regular mm-hmm. basis, maybe even patronize on a regular basis. Next time you go to Hy-Vee Foods, look at the shopping cart, which will say employee-owned on the handle.
Right.
Because they are proudly employee-owned. The difference has to do with the employee stock ownership plans are governed by federal law, the ERISA law, which is the law created in 1974, which governs retirement plans, 401ks, and pension plans, and so forth. And the way the plans are set up in the beginning, there's nothing in ERISA, that law, that requires there be a separation of ownership and control. But very often, the way these plans get set up is that there's a trustee who owns who's the representative of the trust. And there will be a trust that holds the equity of the firm in trust for the employees who work there.
Yeah, so it's separated, and the employees own these shares, but they don't really have voting.
That's exactly right.
They don't have voting rights.
They are what's called. They are what's referred to as legally. They're known as beneficial owners, meaning that they receive the benefit of their ownership, but they don't have the control rights. Those control rights belong with the trustee of the firm, who is required by law to operate for the benefit of the people for the employees who work there.
Okay.
So it's a slightly different model. And as I mentioned before, we tend to think of these two sets of rights associated with the firm, which is the ownership and control rights. In a worker cooperative, those two belong to the people who work there. In an employee stock ownership plan, those are typically separated, and the rights to the ownership rights or the rights to profits belong to the workers, but the control rights belong to the plan, or they belong to the trust.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Well, I wish we had a little bit more time, because I'd like to talk about how unions can be mm-hmm. involved with cooperatives, but what incentive do unions have if they don't have member? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that's probably, I'll say that for another day.
Sure.
I think we're running out of time here. But I do want to let our listeners know, if you want to find out more about worker cooperatives, you can check out the Democracy at Work Institute at institute.coop. That's institute.coop. So I want to thank you for being on the show today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This is Professor Eric Olson from University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's an economics professor. This is the Heartland Labor Forum. Stay tuned now for Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, journeyman wireman with IBW Local 124 and secretary of the Greater Kansas City Industrial Workers of the World. Established in 1869, just 4 years after the passage of the 13th Amendment, the National Labor Union, more commonly known as the Colored National Labor Union, CNLU, was formed by African Americans to organize their labor collectively on a national level. The CNLU, like other labor unions in the United States, was created with the goal of improving the working conditions and quality of life for its members. African Americans were then excluded from existing labor unions, such as when white workers formed the original National Labor Union, NLU, in 1866. William Silvis, president of the original NLU, made a speech in which he argued that there should be no distinction of race or nationality within the ranks of his organization. In 1869, several black delegates were invited to the annual meeting of the NLU, among them Isaac Myers, a prominent organizer of African American laborers. At the convention, he spoke eloquently for solidarity, saying that white and black workers ought to organize together for higher wages and a comfortable standard of living. During the 1869 original NLU convention, a motion was passed claiming that the organization did not recognize color. However, many labor unions ignored this ruling and continued to remain segregated. Due to the use of black laborers as strikebreakers, there was a great deal of resentment from mostly white unions who saw them as an enemy. It should also be noted that this resentment went both ways, as white strikebreakers were also often employed when black workers went on strike. This strategy of the ruling class to wedge workers apart to prevent their uniting against them has long been a popular one. Of course, another issue was that the white working class was and is the base for violent white supremacist groups. There was also disagreements at that time between black and white workers regarding the priorities of labor unions, with white workers more focused on establishing political power and currency reform, while black workers were more concerned with the ability to own and develop property. As such, black workers broke apart from the NLU and had their own convention later that year, resulting in the creation of the Colored National Labor Union. Ultimately, black labor leaders decided that if they're not going to be given their deserved seats at the NLU, they would just have to start their own. Founded in December 1869 by an assembly of 214 African-American mechanics, engineers, artisans, tradesmen, and tradeswomen, and their supporters in Washington, D.C., this organization was created in pursuit of equal representation for African-Americans in the workforce. Isaac Myers was elected as its first president. During the first convention of the CNLU in December 1869, delegates wrote a petition to Congress. This petition asked for Congress to split public land within the South into farmland to be used by low-income African-American farmers. It also requested that black farmers be given a low-interest loan from the government. Another petition was drafted and sent to Congress in 1871, requesting the commission of an investigation into conditions of affairs in the Southern states. Unfortunately, little response or effects resulted from these efforts. The CNLU also established the Bureau of Labor, based in Washington, D.C. The Bureau of Labor was designed to assist workers of color in organizing throughout the country. As president of the CNLU, Isaac Myers traveled throughout the country, encouraging the organization of black workers and attempting to convince white labor unions to allow workers of color within their organizations. On his trips, he often specifically focused on mechanics and mechanics unions, as he believed that white mechanic labor unions were specifically designed to withhold specific positions from black workers. Unfortunately, upon the CNLU's second annual convention, Myers stated that the organization was not as successful as they had hoped. He claimed that the education and financial resources provided by the CNLU and the Bureau of Labor were insufficient and noted that the Ku Klux Klan's power in the South prevented the organization of black laborers in certain areas. Civil rights activist Frederick Douglass was elected the president of the CNLU in 1872, and his newspaper, The National New Era, was chosen as the official press organ of the CNLU. The CNLU sent delegates to the 1870 National Labor Convention of the white-dominated NLU, but following the NLU's rejection of black abolitionist attorney John M. Langston's admission during the conference, the CNLU broke off most of its contact with the all-white NLU. While Myers had warned against the CNLU becoming a primarily political body as opposed to a trade union party, the election of Frederick Douglass in 1871 reflected the influx of political figures within the organization. Over time, the CNLU became more and more politically focused, to the point where it essentially began to function as a branch of the Republican Party, resulting in less trade union focus and activity and less contact with trade unionists across the country. By 1872, the CNLU had ceased most of its operations and would eventually disband, just as the mostly white NLU had when their designation as a political party fractured their organization. These first experiments and national organization, while enjoying relatively brief lifespans, would greatly inform the leaders and other members involved in them on how to organize better next time as the Knights of Labor. This has been an adaptation of the Wikipedia article on the CLNU. Have a great evening, everyone, and thanks for listening.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Wyandotte County, third Saturday, Democratic Breakfast, Saturday, February 16th, 8:15 for breakfast, 9 a.m. for the speaker, at Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue, KCK. Speakers are Mayor David Alvey and State Representative Pam Curtis. RSVP for breakfast to Scott Mackey at scottmackey08@yahoo.com. March for Our Lives, KC, Saturday, February 16th, 2 p.m., Unity Temple on the Plaza, 707 West 47th Street. Medea Benjamin, Building a Peace Movement in an Era of Endless War, Saturday, February 16th, 6:30 p.m., All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut in Kansas City. For tickets, go to kkfi.org/events. This is a benefit for KKFI. Greater KC Justice Coalition, Tuesday, February 19th, 5:30 to 7 p.m. at 2400 Troost in Kansas City, Missouri. And Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meeting is at a new time. It is the third Tuesday, so it'll be February 19th at 6:30 p.m. at All Souls UU Church. Finally, free legal help for victims of wage theft, Monday, February 25th, 5 to 8 p.m. at El Centro, 7th and Minnesota in Kansas City, Kansas. That's it for the Heartland Labor Forum. Tune in next week. Our show is another edition of our mayoral forum. It's a surprise who's going to be on. And Rebuilding Power in Open Shop America, a Labor Notes Guide. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
The coming.